Thank you so much, Father Tim. And it is wonderful to be back here in your swanky new parish hall and Father Tim's fundraising and all. They have me on various microphones, so I'm going to move the podium here and hide behind it in case there are tomatoes thrown. But I know you're very nonviolent. Thanks for coming out, everybody. Nice to be here. I was told that there was going to be a foot of snow on Tuesday when I flew in to Massachusetts, so I'm glad to be here and to make it. And thanks for all the great good you do here at the parish and in Binghamton in a bad time, I know, but I really thank you, and I really want to encourage you, and it's nice to see a few friends of mine here, too. And I can't remember, but I think I was here at his first parish almost 30 years ago. And so he's been one of my heroes and mentors. How about a round of applause for Father Tim? Yeah. One of the great priests in the United States. But I'm nervous in front of all of you holy Binghamton peacemakers. And you see these microphones? I don't even know what they're for or who's listening. I don't know why he has very... But anyway, I'm reminded of the young priest who's giving his first sermon and he's really nervous and he comes to the podium. Oh, look, I have it on backwards. And he taps on the microphone and he says, something's wrong with this microphone. And the congregation goes, and also with you. Now, I told that joke the last time I was here on the time before that in 1996. That's my only joke. Pretty sad. I'm traveling around the country talking about my new book, and so that's what I proposed talking about. And somebody said, well, we know what you did during the pandemic. I'm on a 65-city speaking tour. Yeah, I left January 11th, and I've been traveling since. Where am I? I was in Massachusetts yesterday. I'll be Erie tomorrow and preaching in Harlem on Sunday, nonstop till May 25th. Because what do we do in this bad time, you know? It's so depressing and discouraging. And in fact, I did spend the pandemic. I had just moved to California and joined the Diocese of Monterey, and I was living by the ocean, and the pandemic came. So I was feeling called to do this for years. And that's what I want to talk about, the Gospel of Peace, a commentary on Matthew, Mark, and Luke from the perspective of nonviolence. And there's no comment. Nobody writes commentaries anymore, but it's a line by line going through the Gospels as if Gandhi or Dr. King are going through each sentence saying, see how nonviolent Jesus is. He's even more nonviolent than Gandhi and Dr. King. Isn't that great? And I think it's very, very hopeful stuff, and it's so moving to see our holy prophet up here, you know, like that. Of course, I wanted to do Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four Gospels. I wanted a four-volume box set. But the publisher said, no. Somebody's got to stop you. And it was a setback. Anyway, I hope you all buy five copies and give one to every priest in New York State and minister. Seriously, this is kind of my project. And I want to talk about this clumsy word nonviolence and Jesus and then say a little bit about Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And, you know, it's just so overwhelming and depressing to look at the world. And that's why I'm talking about this. Between Gaza, you know, it's just genocide that's funded by us, to Ukraine, which was all set up by us. We just pushed Putin to invade. We've been at it for 25 years, and it worked. Now it got rid of all the nuclear disarmament treaties, and people are making billions and trillions on war. And catastrophic climate change, and closer to nuclear war than ever, and gun violence, and racism, and Christian nationalism, and dare I mention fascism. Father Tim doesn't want me to mention, so I'll just say he who must not be named is hovering. And so it's just a very difficult time every which way, and it's going to get worse. It's going to get much worse. So I'm proposing that as things get worse, as we get older, more than ever, like Martin, we put all our chips on nonviolence and the nonviolence of Jesus. There we'll have a ground to stand on. What they didn't show there, you know, there's no footage of that hour-long speech. I think they destroyed it very quickly. But three sentences before that, he said, I've been to the mountaintop. He said, the choice is no longer violence or nonviolence. It's nonviolence or nonexistence. And that's what we are being asked by the Creator to live through and endure and do our best. What? I always say to lead humanity back from the brink, to help humanity, one another, choose nonviolence. That means we have to choose nonviolence and work in Binghamton and New York, such an important place you live in, to help create what? A nonviolent church? A nonviolent Binghamton? A global grassroots movement of nonviolence for justice, disarmament, and creation way beyond Martin and Gandhi. That's the only hope of the world, is this way of active nonviolence. I like this word. I know nobody does. But poor Martin and Gandhi talked about nonviolence morning, noon, and night. That's all they talked about. I've studied them. Like, I really studied them. And that's what they talked about. I mean, nobody uses the word now. And as a kid, I decided I'm going to talk about nonviolence. Love, peace. I think the meanings have been so watered down now. We're all for love, and we're all for peace, and let's bomb and kill everybody, you know, and be insane. It's like we live in a zombie movie, I think. Really. And sanity, the only sanity and healing and hope is through the way of nonviolence. That's what our prophet is trying to teach us. So 125 years ago, just to say a word about nonviolence, Gandhi takes this clumsy word from Jainism and Hinduism, ahimsa, and starts talking about it in South Africa. And he uses the old definition, do no harm in thought, word, or deed. Okay, we've all heard that. Let's think about that for a minute. You're never going to harm another human being ever again for the rest of your life. You're never going to say another harmful word toward another human being ever again for the rest of your life. You're never going to think another harmful thought toward another human being ever again for the rest of your life. How's that going for y'all? That's the spiritual life. That's why we need God. That's what he's trying to teach us. And Gandhi is mulling this, and he's getting it from the Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. And one day he goes, oh my God, this is a whole new way of life. This is the spiritual life. This is the way of God. This is the law of God, the politics of God. This is the methodology of the world that God intends, that the way to change the world is bottom-up, people power, global grassroots movements of total nonviolence in pursuit of universal love, justice, and peace with all creation. And that's, you get that from Jesus to Gandhi and Dr. King. It's spectacular stuff. In my book, The Nonviolent Life, I talk about nonviolence then as three attributes, trying to be totally nonviolent to yourself. Really think about that from now on, because this just doesn't work. You know, violence doesn't work. Our beating ourselves up doesn't work and putting ourselves down. So we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to non-cooperate with our own inner violence. We are going to be a place of peace where the God of peace can live in us. We're going to make peace with ourselves. Isn't that lovely to think about that? At the same time, practice meticulous interpersonal nonviolence toward every human being in Binghamton and on the planet, and all the creatures and Mother Earth. How's that going for you?
That's all.
Huh?
That's all.
That's all. That's not even it. That's, I said there were three things. I'm only at number two. And that's just one point. You have to do all. So think of the person who just, let's just say you'd rather see them die. I'm just saying. Okay, you have some difficulties with. They push your buttons. Let's put it that way. That's your teacher of nonviolence. The person who bugs you the most is your guru because they're exposing all your junk. Now you get to be nonviolent and you get to go and work on it with that one person you're thinking of. Isn't that interesting? That's the way the mystery of this works, and we're going to constantly on this never-ending journey of progress, not perfection, becoming ever more nonviolent. But the third thing, are you writing this down? You have to have one foot in the global grassroots movement for justice, disarmament, creation. You got to do something. I don't care what it is. Nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. Pick something and do your something for the environment. Like here in the parish, Tim's been telling me about the Care of Creation group. That's great. Or the homeless, or fighting racism, or fighting war. I heard you had a march here the other day. That was wonderful. I mean, you know, there's so much to do. Just pick a cause and be involved. Because if you're not involved somehow in the global network, as Tutu, my friend, would say, you're the problem. Your silence is complicity with global systemic violence and injustice. But if you're just activism, you're also the problem. Because if you're not doing your inner nonviolence and not working on nonviolence in your relationships, that's why I'm saying it's this holistic thing. Well, Gandhi and Martin, they come along and they say, Gandhi said in about 1910, Jesus is the greatest person of nonviolence in the history of the world. I said that each time I was here. And then poor Gandhi goes on and says, and the only people who don't know that Jesus is nonviolent are Christians. I won't even mention Catholics. Is he right? If he's right, everything has to change. We have to become Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and all our saints and heroes like Tom Gumbleton and the Barricans. We have to become people of total holistic nonviolence. And that's what why I did this book, to show everything we've thought about Jesus for 2,000 years. Boy, is this an arrogant thing to say, but it's my specialty, so here goes. Everything we've been taught is wrong. Jesus is meticulously, totally nonviolent. As our friend Dan Berrigan said to me long ago when I was a kid, Jesus didn't have a mean bone in his body. And yet we're out bombing and killing in his name, you know. So I just find this so hopeful. So can I say a little bit about Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Would that be okay? And then we'll have time for comments or reflections or rebuttal. Matthew, well, you all know this. It's written for the Jewish Christian community, the Jewish people who are becoming Christians. So they're emphasizing, whoever Matthew the writer is, the Jewish nature of Jesus. We found the Messiah, is the message. Unfortunately, he's not quite the guy we had hoped for. He's totally nonviolent. Jesus thinks he's Gandhi. Can I say that, Tim? He thinks he's Martin Luther King. I thought you'd laugh at that, but none of my jokes are working here. He presents Jesus as the new Moses coming down the mountain with the new commandments called the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, 6, and 7, which Gandhi said are the greatest teachings of nonviolence in the history of the world. Gandhi said in South Africa, I want to be a person of nonviolence, so I have to read my handbook. So Gandhi read from Matthew 5, 6, and 7 every morning and every evening for the last 45 years of his life. Did you know that? And he's not Christian, by the way. He's a Hindu. Did I hear some of you were Christians? Are you reading the Sermon on the Mount every day? Think about that. I invite you to start doing that. I'm very serious. Gandhi said, this is our catechism. This is a how to be a human being. Forget it as poetry or pious teachings. Just take the guy's advice. And what's so interesting is that Gandhi was not Gandhi. Gandhi was really a bumbling idiot, and he would not mind me saying that because he said it of himself. Gandhi became Gandhi. because he took the teaching seriously and said, I'm just going to do what the guy says. I don't understand most of it. And he's probably wrong, because aren't we smarter than Jesus? Jesus was not that smart. No, he was very much smarter than us. And I think at times, was Gandhi the only person who ever lived who read from the Sermon on the Mount every day? That's why he's the only one who became Gandhi. And Dr. King stepping into Gandhi's wake and carrying on. So the Sermon on the Mount, I don't think we can talk about it enough. And I'm so glad it begins the four Gospels, really. And you've heard it a million times. It begins with the Beatitudes. But did you know in the Aramaic that the word blessed is not blessed? And it's definitely not happy are. In the language that Jesus spoke, the translation is, are you ready? I want you to memorize this with me. Arise, get up, and walk forth. And we translate that as blessed are. Oh, you're so nice. Not at all. This sounds like Jesus, who is a revolutionary movement organizer, totally empowering these poor people on the outskirts of this horrible, evil empire. Arise and walk forth, you poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn, all of us who are grieving this world. Blessed are those who are meek, gentle, nonviolent. That's the biblical word for nonviolence, which interestingly he connects with creation. The more you go deeper into nonviolence, then you will inherit the earth. He's a genius. But arise and walk forth. Be empowered, you people of nonviolence. You who are hungry and thirsting for justice. You who are merciful and pure in heart. That's that inner nonviolence again. Totally nonviolent of heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Arise and walk forth into the culture of war, all you holy peacemakers. You are the beloved daughters and sons of the Creator of the universe, who is a God of peace. And so you just walk into the culture and say no to every war because you're a peacemaker. Hey, I'd love to kill for you, but I'm a son of God, so what can I do? God's a God of peace. Love. That's why we do what we do. That's the heart of nonviolence from that teaching. Identity, identity, identity. Your fundamental identity is you are the beloved daughter of God. You are the beloved son of the God of peace. The culture of America is always telling you, no, you're a good American. You want to be all you can be, join the Marines and go and kill our enemies, or those who we want to steal their stuff. And it's not going to go over too well. Blessed are those persecuted for working for justice. And then when they insult you and call you every name, rejoice and be glad. Now you're like the prophets. Now you get to be like Gandhi and Dr. King. Isn't that exciting? You're looking at me like, he's got to cut back on the coffee. Which is true. I've been drinking coffee all day. I'm sorry, Tim. We're going to be here till 11 o'clock at this rate. I get so excited about it. I think it's worth reading every day. The news is not worth looking at every day. This is really worth reading every day. Not my book, but the Bible, the Gospels. Okay, my book is too. Thank you. No, the Gospels. The Gospels. This is really great. And then we get the sixth antithesis. You have heard it said, but I say to you, leading up to the fifth antithesis. I'll just speak on two of those if you can stand it. Because we don't hear about it enough. You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which Gandhi said just leaves the whole world blind and toothless. Isn't that what happening in Gaza? Tim was just saying that to me tonight. Haven't we learned this age-old truth yet? No. And it's a never-ending downward spiral. Violence in response to violence always leads to further violence, as Jesus says in the Garden of Gethsemane. What goes around comes around. War doesn't work. War never brings peace. It always leads to further wars. This is insanity. It's actually clinical insanity, trying to repeat behavior thinking that this time we'll get peace. But it has nothing to do with peace. There's a lot of money to be made killing children. In the United States, a lot of people are making money. So You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, I want you to memorize this sentence with me, because I think it's the most important sentence in the Bible. In the Greek, it says, offer no violent resistance to one who does evil. That's the sentence Gandhi read every day and meditated on. That's why he became Gandhi. Offer no violent resistance to one who does evil. Someone's going to do evil to you, you cannot do evil back. They're going to be violent to you, you don't respond to violence. Gandhi went like, well, what do I do? Nonviolent, non-cooperation resistance. You don't do nothing. So the world says someone's going to do violence to you. You got two options. You fight back with violence or you run away. Jesus says, third option, stand your ground, don't flee, and be nonviolent. Engage your opponent. Speak the truth about your common humanity with the spirit of love, with the Holy Spirit of God working through you. Say, don't hurt me. I'm a human being. What's wrong? Until the scales fall from his eyes and he repents and you live happily ever after as friends. That's how it works. And that's how it's worked for me. In soup kitchens and war zones, when I lived in El Salvador, my sole job was to go out in a refugee camp and greet the death squads. And you, if you are willing, it's scary, but so is violence. And if you pull out a gun, you're probably going to be killed. So this is just means you're going to get over your fear and engage people nonviolently. Only Gandhi's reading that every morning and says, I think this is meant to be applied to nations and the whole world. Can I get all of India to nonviolently non-cooperate with British imperial domination and get them to leave as friends? And he proves it works. Dr. King said Gandhi was the first person to apply the Sermon on the Mount as a universal ethic and political methodology of social transformation. And Martin went on to say, it always works when it's tried. Now, I can give you chapter and verse of that. We now know this through the research that's been done in the last 20 years by the great Erica Chenoweth. And I can tell you about her book if you want to know later. She's this famous Harvard social scientist who studied every war from 1900 to 2006 with a massive team of research. Her massive book is like reading a physics book. It's all math. It's horrible. No. And she proves that in every conflict, violent revolution, and war, in opposition to tyranny and invasion, where nonviolence is tried, it works. Everything Jesus said is true. So we now don't have a real reason to ignore this. And nations around the world and the United Nations are all studying Erica Chenoweth's work, even though we're not. The Vatican is too, interestingly now. Well, anyway, I just think this is just incredibly important, and I'm moved by the story about it because, you know, I don't know if you know why we know so Gandhi did this, but it all goes back to the abolitionists. And I always feel the abolitionists when I come here, you know, to Binghamton and think of Rochester and Syracuse and Seneca Falls and all. Just incredible people, you know, who are working to end slavery. That's all they had to do. Our job is harder. I thought you might laugh at that. I don't even know what I'm saying. William Lloyd Garrison in 1821 in Rochester stood up and gave the famous speech and said, tonight we're announcing the abolition of slavery. And, you know, everybody thought he was nuts. And he reclaimed the imagination of what it means to be a human being, and they built a movement. We have to announce the beginning of the abolition of war and nuclear weapons and racism itself and poverty and executions and using fossil fuels and corporate greed. The whole world has to change. That's what I mean. William Lloyd Garrison had this clumsy phrase from the abolitionist women Quakers in England called passive resistance, because that was the bad translation from Matthew 5. But it meant nonviolence, but it led to the Civil War, you know, and it didn't work. They weren't what we might have hoped. And so William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass renounced nonviolence. Do you know the history of this? Because it's involved your area, and it's interesting, because we're their heirs. All of them but one. William Lloyd Garrison's number two. He was just like Dr. King. So was Frederick Douglass. He was like Andrew Young. It was a guy named Aidan Bellow. Nobody knows about him. He lived about 1890, formed a kind of a Gandhian ashram, which is a museum now in Connecticut. And his son, he had a pile of kids, as he was growing old and before he died, got his father to write his philosophy of nonviolence. Okay, a 50-page paper. Aidan dies, the great man, the only one of the movement that remained faithful. Are you with me on all of this? I'm talking about Matthew 5, believe it or not. I get so excited about this. And the kid publishes 100 copies of it, which is hard to do, and mails them to the 100 most famous people on the planet, the president, the vice president, the king, and Queen Elizabeth, I mean, you know, Queen Victoria. And who's the most famous person on the planet? Leo Tolstoy. Tolstoy gets it. Nobody responded and changed his life, gave up writing, gave up everything. He'd just done War and Peace and said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life teaching what Aidan Bellow says. So he writes this 500-page massive book called The Kingdom of God is Within You and puts the 50-page paper at the beginning of it. And it's a whole book saying, if you want to follow Jesus, you have to practice total nonviolence and resist. And his whole life goal, Leo Tolstoy, is to convert the evil Russian Orthodox Church, which just works for the state and the czar and the war machine, just like the churches in the United States just serve the Pentagon and, oh, did I say that? You see what I mean? And he totally failed, Leo Tolstoy. But he gets this letter a year before he died from some unknown guy in South Africa. Dear Mr. Tolstoy, I read every sentence of your book, and I promise to live it out every day of my life. Mohandas K. Gandhi. And Gandhi was mobilized because of that book, because of Aidan Bellow, all because of this sentence. So Gandhi then spent every day studying that sentence, which is the heart of everything, friends. And it explains the methodology of the cross. We prefer to suffer and die rather than to kill, you know. So, and that's just the fifth antithesis. The sixth, you have heard it said, love your country, men, and hate your enemies. But I say, agape, unconditional love to the people, the nation state. It's nation state language. It's not the person across the street you don't like, your enemy. No, the enemy of your nation. You give your life in love for them and then pray for all the people who are going to persecute you. It's the most political sentence in all of written history up to that point. And we know no one had ever said that before. Love your enemies. But I say to you, love your enemies. Why? Martin, I could never figure this out. And then I'm reading when I was like 24, every word Martin wrote. And he has this sermon. And of course, only Martin would pick it up because he was wanting to know why too. Didn't we just agree? You are the sons and daughters of the God who lets the sun rise on the good and the bad and the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. In other words, love your enemies because you're sons and daughters of a God of universal nonviolent love. In this most political sentence in the Bible, we have the most explicit description of the nature of the mystery of God in that one sentence. It's spectacular. Is that the God you worship? Do we want a God of universal love, universal peace, universal compassion, total nonviolence? What does that mean? That's what I'm interested in. And I think that's the only hope for the world. And that's why this is worth giving our time and attention to, in my mind. So Matthew goes on, and he's basically, after he explains all the spectacular nonviolence in the Sermon on the Mount, if you see it as concrete teachings on how to be a person of total nonviolence in a world of insanity, then it works, if you read it that way, as if Gandhi and King are saying these words. So when you go home, I invite you to read it. Well, then he's saying, you know, the more you do this, the more they're going to hate you, and then they're going to arrest some of you, and they're going to kill you, but keep at it and persevere. This is the greatest thing we can do with your lives. And there's just very lovely touches, like, for example, in Matthew 12, come to me, all you who labor. Why? For I am gentle and meek and humble of heart. In other words, I am totally nonviolent. And that is so critical, because later we see in, I think it's Matthew 26 or so, well, he turns to the religious authorities and goes, you brood of vipers, you whitened sepulchers, you're like dead men's bones that people walk over. And he's yelling and cussing at him, and we're all reading it going, oh, this is good. Now we're getting somewhere. No more of this nonviolence. No, it's not like it at all. Jesus is never angry in Matthew or Luke. And actually, the word anger is only used twice. Once in Mark with the man with the withered hand, and once in John, but in the Greek, it's not anger. He was just very upset, which is different. He was beside himself. So that's why in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, if you're going to live a life of total nonviolence, avoid these two emotions, anger and fear. You have heard it said, thou shalt not kill. I say, don't even get angry. I didn't even get into that. And blessed are those who mourn, grieve. So we avoid anger and fear, but we practice two, he recommends two emotions, grief and joy. I think that's a way forward for all of us in this bad time. And all the great saints who were my friends, like Dan Berrigan, Archbishop Tutu, and Thich Nhat Hanh, they were people of deep grief and profound joy. Tutu should not have been allowed out in public. He was just embarrassing. It was so funny, I can tell you this. And Joan Baez says Martin was the funniest person she ever met in her life. You don't think that about the great man. But that makes sense to me, because he's a Sermon on the Mount person. Because he's rejoicing and glad because, hey, I'm getting to be like Jesus and I'm going to be part of the transformation of the world. So how do we love our enemies? How are you doing that? How are we serving a God of universal love and peace? And at what cost? And what is our image of Jesus? Well, if he's not yelling at them, what is he doing? He's grieving, and he's lamenting. And, you know, I had the campaign at Los Alamos for 20 years where they build all the nuclear weapons. And, you know, I was friends with the great Zen Buddhist through Dan, Thich Nhat Hanh, and I would go and tell him. And Thich Nhat Hanh would talk like Jesus. And it would be the same thing. And I'll do an impression of Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Buddhist hero of nonviolence. This is what he would say about the people at Los Alamos. You mean to tell me that they're so hypocritical, they're obsessed with death, and they're building one? Did you hear what I said? I rest my case. That's Jesus talking about hypocrisy. There's no yelling. Be careful to project onto Jesus your violence, your anger, your resentment, your hatred. He's not like us. He's showing us how we can all be totally nonviolent, people of universal love. So Thich Nhat Hanh would say, you mean to tell me that all the 20,000 people who build nuclear weapons at Los Alamos are all Catholic and Christian? They all go to church. Every one of them goes to Mass. They build nuclear weapons every day. Don't they see that they're total hypocrites? That they're obsessed with death, that they're actually possessed by death, that in fact they're dead? You'd use the same language as Jesus. That's what I'm trying to say. Jesus is using language to try to wake us up, and we just presume it's violence. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke, if you're still hanging in there with me, tell the same story. Jesus organizes the poor in Galilee and turns and marches to Jerusalem, just like Gandhi on the Salt March, just like Dr. King on the Selma to Montgomery March. And he goes into the temple where the religious authorities work with the empire to oppress all the people and steal all their money. And he turns over the tables of the bankers, taking all the poor people's money, and prevents people from coming and going. He does like a 30-second sit-in. And then he teaches for the rest of the day. He doesn't yell at anybody, get angry at anybody, hit anybody, hurt anybody, whip anybody, kill anybody, or drop any nuclear bombs. He's as gentle as Gandhi, but he's not passive. He's trouble and dangerous and daring and provocative and public and bold and a revolutionary. And if you're messing around like that in the sacred place where they're making a fortune, you're going to be arrested and tortured and killed. And that's what happens in 24 hours. It's not brain surgery. He's not predicting, I can see the future. It's obvious. If you're going to do that, just as he knows, Martin knows they're going to kill him. And Gandhi knew they were going to kill him. Gandhi knew his assassin for 40 years. If you really study the fine print, it was very clear. So what I'm saying is a spectacular, daring act of nonviolence. And then he's at the Passover meal, and Matthew emphasizes this, and he takes the bread, my body broken for you. He takes the cup, my blood poured out for you, shed for you. This is the new covenant. No. If he were a good Roman like he should have been, like the Messiah we hope for, if he were a good American, what would he have said? What every president has said. Go break their bodies for me. Go shed their blood for me. No, friends. My body broken for you, my blood shed for you. Do this. Every time you participate in Eucharist, you're entering into the new covenant of total nonviolence, the spiritual methodology of God, that we prefer to suffer and die rather than to inflict suffering or to kill people. We are people of universal love with one catch. There is no cause for which we will ever support the taking of a single human life ever again. We just don't support killing. And we don't support the killing of people who kill people to show that you shouldn't kill people. And we don't support the bombing of people who bomb people to show that you shouldn't bomb people. In fact, we give our lives to stop the killing. That's the Eucharist. You don't like that? Go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And he's agonizing over God's will. And he's praying. And, you know, it's all amazing. The soldiers come. Peter takes up the sword, according to John's gospel. But in Matthew, it says, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. You see there, and Jesus is about to be arrested, about to be killed. In fact, in Luke's version, friends, if you read it carefully, it's about to be a massacre. Let's say there's 50 people in the Jesus community, men and women. The core disciples, the women, and some kids, and they're in this hideout in the middle of night, and here the troops, the death squads come in with all the religious authorities. You know, they are all armed, and the gang has been desperate to be violent throughout the Gospels. Peter's thinking, as I always joke, if there's ever a just war, this is the moment when it's justified to kill for God, and he's right. We have to kill to protect the Holy One, God. And just as he goes to kill, the commandment comes down, put down the sword. Those are the last words of Jesus to the church. But Luke ups the ante because he says Peter strikes the ear of the slave. He's not even one of the killers. He's just another oppressed person caught up. Now wait. If Peter struck the high priest's servant's ear and cut it off, and they are 150 people, all of them with arms, what's going to happen? In 2 seconds, everyone's going to be killed. It's going to be a massacre. And Jesus steps in and intervenes and saves everybody's life. Put down the sword. And there is no massacre. And he heals the man. And the disciples run away because they want nothing to do with nonviolence. And Matthew, just makes a very big fuss about the meticulous legality of the execution of Jesus. The crucifixion of Jesus is totally legal, just as nuclear war and destroying the planet and the sixth extinction and the genocide in Gaza, everything like it's totally legal. You can go ahead and do that. Because we got to make money. What Matthew does that nobody else does, I think it's hilarious. It's fantastic. You can't make this stuff up. Boy, you're looking at me like, oh, God, this guy needs Valium or something. Okay, that might be true, but I love that. They kill him. And then the religious authorities are still not satisfied. And they're going, well, these uppity peace movement people, they're going to do something. They're probably going to steal the body. We better go. They have a confab. They meet with Pilate and all the muckety-mucks. So he agrees, too. So the centurion takes about 100 soldiers with their weapons, and they go to the tomb. And there's the big rock. And they put soldiers everywhere, and the centurion is there, and they're going to guard it. And Matthew says he puts the seal of the emperor on the rock, and it says in Latin, "We killed you, you're dead, now stay there." Resurrection is illegal. It's just civil disobedience again. He breaks out what he's not supposed to, and he's out and about today, continuing his illegal underground grassroots movement. You're not buying it for a minute, but I love it. This is our guy. He's still nonviolent, and he's back still causing trouble. Mark has none of this. Mark has no infancy narrative, no Moses, no Sermon on the Mount, nothing. It's just, and all of Mark, like 90% of it is in Matthew, but the word that's used over and over in Mark is immediately, 41 times. Jesus got up and immediately went over there and he helped that poor guy who was possessed and he healed him on the Sabbath and he broke the law and he shouldn't have been doing that. But then he got up and immediately went over there and he was with the leper and he healed that guy on the Sabbath and he shouldn't have been doing that. Then he immediately got up and he was hanging out with those uppity women, which he shouldn't have been doing, and that was illegal too. Then he got, and he's just like nonstop. That's why I think Mark is a nonstop action thriller. You're not buying that either, so I can't say. Tom Cruise, Mission Impossible, it's not working. Okay, here's my take, since it's 10 o'clock already. One sentence summary of the Gospel of Mark, which you're going to be hearing if you go to Mass this year. Here goes. Listen carefully. I'm serious now. The Gospel of Mark is a call to radical discipleship to the nonviolent Jesus as permanent nonviolent resistance to the empire, to the culture of violence and war, permanently for the rest of your life, as your discipleship, as your obedience to the God of peace, as your welcoming of God's reign of peace and nonviolence here on earth. Discipleship is resistance, according to Mark. It's fantastic. It's really, and it's scary, and it's hopeful, and you end up like Martin and Gandhiji. Or Dorothy Day, and you know, full-on resistance, which is what we're going to have to do for the rest of our lives. If you're alive, there's work to be done resisting this culture and transforming it, but through the power of nonviolence. Luke comes along and just is, he's like on LSD. He just makes the thing. No, really, John is on LSD. Luke would, I better not even go there. Okay, never mind. He says, who is Jesus' teacher of nonviolence? And he gives the answer. He starts off with that. Mary. Mary doesn't get a line in Matthew or Mark. She's probably never even mentioned. In fact, in Mark, she doesn't come off that well. She and the 8 brothers and sisters of Jesus come to take Jesus away because they think he's insane. That's the first time she's mentioned. And if you read the fine print in Mark, it says, and there standing at the cross were the women. So Mark clearly has only the women are faithful to the end. And he names them. Mary of Magdala. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Salome. Wait, who is that number 2 person? The names of Jesus' brothers, not his sisters are mentioned, but the brothers begin with James and Joseph. Mary is now named in Mark, not as the mother of Jesus, but as an ordinary disciple. Isn't that great? Do you see how she had to be converted? Am I going on too long? Okay, well, I get carried away. In Luke, he says, it sums up the whole life of Jesus in the 3 spiritual movements of nonviolence. Number 1, Mary and the Annunciation as contemplative nonviolence. That's how the gospel begins. Brilliant. Mary's a person of prayer and meditation. She just lives for God, as we all do. That's what we do. We are for God, morning, noon, and night. And one day, she has an encounter with the Holy. And she's terrified. And then she's confused. And then she's like, huh? What? And then she's like, oh, well, hey, what? Behold, I am the servant of the God of peace. Whatever God wants, I do. That's a no-brainer. Are there any questions? You know, that's how nonviolence works. It's all about your identity. The key there right at the beginning is Mary knows who she is because she's a person of contemplative prayer. She lives in and for God alone, which is where we're all headed. I think that's for me.
I thought I turned it off.
That's okay. I thought it was funny, but apparently it wasn't. That's Mary. Anyway, the experience of God, knowing who you are, declaring that I do whatever God wants, and therefore, of course, I'll do this, leads to the second movement, Mary and the Visitation as active nonviolence. Do you see? You reach out and serve someone in need, in this case, Elizabeth. So what did two holy women do who give their lives to God? They start talking about God. They're not talking about the bad news. They're talking about, you have no idea what God did to me in my life. Well, you don't know what God is doing in my life. Well, blessed are you. No, blessed are you. No, blessed is everybody. They just go a little over the top. And they're talking Beatitudes. There's so much teaching there that happens in active nonviolence. You're full of hope and possibilities because you're focusing on God, not what the culture and the TV and Fox News tells you to be focusing on. The bad news. There's a point to what I'm trying to make there somewhere. And that leads to the third movement, Mary and the Magnificat as prophetic nonviolence. Mary becomes greater than Jeremiah. My soul proclaims the greatness of the God of peace. I can see it now. God's nonviolence is from age to age. It's all through history. You see it, Moses and the prophets, and then the early church, and then St. Francis and St. Clair, and then the abolitionists and the suffragists, and then Dr. King and Gandhi, and now the thousands of grassroots movements of nonviolence around the world. That's the way God works. That's the journey of all of us, contemplative to active to prophetic nonviolence. So Luke then comes in. Luke 4 is the only one who has this, and has Jesus come into the synagogue on the Sabbath morning and comes to the podium and opens up the scroll to Isaiah chapter 61, the most revolutionary text of nonviolence, maybe in written history, and says, the Spirit of the God of peace is on me to proclaim good news to the poor of the earth, to liberate all the oppressed and even the oppressors, to give vision to all the blind, the whole human race, to liberate and free everybody, and to announce the Jubilee year. And he says the most incredible sentence in history. Today the scriptures are fulfilled in your hearing. The Jubilee year? Okay, who reads that? The book of Leviticus, every 7 years times 7 years, and the 49th year plus one, the end of the year, on December 31st, every human being will gather all their money together. What? Okay, Bezos, Gates, he who shall not be named, Biden, all of them billionaires, the generals, the corporations, the war makers. Everybody gathers all money on the planet into one, and it's redistributed equally to every human being on the entire planet, gets the equal same amount on January 1st, according to the book of Leviticus, which Luke says is Jesus' inauguration speech. It's just so far beyond capitalism, communism, socialism, any ism. This is total revolution. In other words, Luke begins his gospel by having Jesus throw down the gauntlet and announce in the synagogue in Capernaum the beginning of the permanent revolution of nonviolence that continues today. It's fantastic. And you and I want to be part of that. And at first they're excited, and then they want to throw them off the cliff and want to kill them because it means we all have to change. And eventually they kill them. And we get the Sermon on the Plain. I'll just end with Luke 10, which is my favorite. He sends 72 disciples ahead of him in pairs, just like Gandhi and King. in movement organizing. It's classic labor movement organizing. He's marching from Galilee to Jerusalem, and we don't think about this. This is how change happens, folks. Bottom up, people power movement. And the word is, go on your way. I'm sending you out. That's your job. You're to go. That's why Martin Luther King defined the church. Dan Berrigan told me this. He said, I heard Dr. King say this at Selma. You won't find it in any written thing. Dr. King said, my definition of the church is the place you go from, which changes everything. I'm sending you as lambs into the midst of wolves, totally nonviolent, into a whole culture of wolves, and you're going to be eaten alive. That's his image of each one of us. So we want to really be lambs and renounce our wolf nature. We want to disarm our inner wolf. I thought you'd be impressed by that, but it's not working here. But St. Francis of Assisi, the wolf, you didn't get all that. Never mind. You got it. That's even worse. And you have to do three things. Number one, heal all the victims of violence. That's all what you're doing here in Binghamton. We're healing. We're all victims of violence. We're going to heal each other. Number two, you expel the demons of violence. You say to people, you don't have to be obsessed with the NRA anymore. You don't have to be a slave to the Republican Party or America or the military or he who must not be named. You see what I mean? Or whatever your favorite obsession is. You help free everybody. And third, you announce the kingdom of God is at hand. Friends, Gandhi, I found a sentence in an obscure passage in Gandhi where he said, this is the most brilliant theology, I think. The kingdom of God is nonviolence. That changes everything. The second coming, eschatology, soteriology, the end of the world is not an apocalypse of violence. It's every human being becoming totally nonviolent. Then Gandhi said, God will reign on earth as God does in heaven. I could go on about that. But what's so amazing about the writing in Luke is it says, they come back, and it says in the Greek, my translation is, they say to Jesus, hey, this nonviolent stuff works. He didn't like that either. They came back rejoicing, and he rejoices and says, don't rejoice because you have power over the demons. Rejoice because your name is in heaven. See, I saw Satan fall like lightning from the sky. Satan is always code language for the Roman Empire. So Jesus is seen whenever people organize in movements, that's the end of injustice and empire. For Jesus, Jesus would see Rosa Parks refusing to get up and give up her seat and say, that's the end of segregation, if you think like Jesus. You see what I mean? And he says, no harm will come to you. I've given you power. But rejoice because your names are written in heaven. So they rejoiced, and then it says, and he rejoiced. The word joy is used five times. And then he turns and starts praising God. So friends, when you're having a bad day and you can't take it anymore and you think the life working for justice and peace and the environment is making no difference whatsoever, you're going to keep at it anyway. You're going to keep doing the good because it's good and doing what's right because it's right, even though we're not going to live to see the change we want to see. We're sowing seeds of peace and nonviolence, for our harvest of peace and nonviolence we'll never live to see. But that's okay. It's in God's hands, better hands than ours. And even then, when you can't take it anymore, keep doing what you can for justice and peace, just to make the poor guy happy. Thanks for listening. Didn't work. I was trying to cheer you up there, but I don't think it worked. I could read to you about the more desperate and discouraging passages if that would help. But there's so much I'm passionate about this in these Gospels. And again, this is the short version of what I really wrote. But I thank you for listening. I thank you for getting my book and supporting the book. And maybe you have some questions or comments. And I can talk about Gaza or love to hear about your work, but I'm really interested in what you think about Jesus, nonviolence, God, and what does it mean for our spiritual lives in the world? What are the political implications of all of this? I wanted to just say, you remind me about the Beatitude Center. So when the pandemic hit, this is basically how I've been supporting myself. I offer Zooms every couple of weeks, and I've, over the last 3 years, and some of you have a yellow flyer about it. I ran out of them, but beatitudecenter.org, and I've had the most incredible people like Cornel West, Jim Lawson, Helen Prejean, name all kinds of the best people in the country, and talking to them about this. And it's really been exciting. And I have a pretty big following now, and I really invite you to look it up and get that. Well, then I'm posting now all the old Zooms that I've done with these great people, and I've done many of them. There's probably 100. They're all free on YouTube, if you look me up on YouTube. And a lot of people have been filming my variations on this talk as I travel around the country. You can probably find that if that interests you. This has been my personal experiment my whole life. I've been 44 years doing this, talking the way I just did every single day of my whole life, anybody who will listen. And it's an amazing experience. But it's meant every single day I've had people, every single day, say, but we got to kill somebody. Usually very nice, pious church people. Priests and nuns. You haven't lit... Well, I won't even... Well, anyway, 44 years ago, I read Gandhi that sentence. Unless democracies turn toward nonviolence and institutionalize nonviolence, they have to move into total fascism. Nazism is the end of every nation on the planet. He said all of that. It makes total sense. And that's what's happening in India. The fascism that's happening right now. It's the heirs of Gandhi's assassins. So we're just seeing it ramped up a little bit. So on the one hand, if you're talking about like that, those cultural groups, first of all, I would just say none of that is Christianity. And that's why I said everything we've been saying is wrong. But it's so interesting to me because not only nobody uses the word nonviolence, number one. But I don't hear people even talking about Jesus. You know, it's this, that, or the other. And for evangelical fascists, it's something. Maybe Samuel. He was good to kill people, or somebody in Chronicles. And for Catholics, it might be some Pope John Paul, who I knew and gave him one of my books on nonviolence. And I think he was beginning to change, but he came out of a very, just a peculiar culture of Poland. So just as Francis comes from Argentina, and as a Jesuit, is a very, I mean, they invented machismo. So the hope for women changing, I think, is very slim under Francis. But in terms of the United States, the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops, if that's where you're getting at or you're talking to, they were founded with one mission, to support the U.S. military. And I've been debating all week to go and meet the head of the Bishops' Conference next month. Who's the head of the so-called military vicariate. His job is to minister to people planning the nuclear war. So that goes back to World War I, and the Catholics were immigrants, and how can we get Catholics, Italians, and Irish especially, to make it? Well, we'll rally them around the troops, and we'll get them all over to go off and kill. Boy, did it work. And now we're just the lead. I was telling Tim some of this. My experience with the priests in California. I mean, I it's just shocking to me. In New Mexico, the priest blesses the nuclear bombs. And, you know, there's priests all over the country. North Carolina, West Virginia has an annual gun day. Bring in your guns, and they pile them up, and they bless them. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be animals. So we're just so far from Jesus, which is, it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. So whether you're talking about the culture or the culture of war or the cultural war-making church is not Jesus. It may be Christendom, which was just became the empire. And I find consolation knowing the history, that the first three centuries were total nonviolence, which meant the minute you were baptized, you were probably going to be executed in 2 or 3 hours. It's pretty much what happened. That's why you waited till you were close to death. No, it was no joke. And people, all their friends were being killed, and that's what you did. And that's what they were encouraging other. You know, I did write a book on the Gospel of John, and the washing of feet has nothing to do with service and washing your feet. And isn't that nice? The Pope washed the feet. That's baloney, friends. You want to hear what it really means? It's preparation for martyrdom. He was anointed by the woman. Only one person took him seriously. They're going to kill me. So she anoints him, and he goes, and he felt better. I can do this. And he goes, that's a good idea. So he symbolically anoints the 12 and prepares them for martyrdom. He bent over. He took up. He rose. All the language in the Greek is Paschal Mystery language. It's clearly about martyrdom. The early church didn't need to learn how to serve. That's all they did. They needed to help get strengthened for execution. But then in 315, Constantine the evil emperor converted supposedly to Christianity, which is an illegal underground movement. It's like Hamas. It's going to bring down the Roman Empire, and it does, only through nonviolence. He legalizes it, says now you can all fight for the Roman army. And so let's throw out the Sermon on the Mount, and turns to the pagan Cicero, and we begin the just war theory. And by the way, then he said, you should organize yourselves like little me's, mini me's. And that's why the bishops were little emperors. I kid you not. This is our history. 1,700 years of seriously, formally renouncing this and coming up with a just war theory. How do you do this? We talk about this. I'm trying to invite a national conversation on Christian nonviolence. This guy did more than anybody. Maybe anybody in human history, maybe way more than Jesus, to spread the message of nonviolence. So you have to kill him. He was only 39, Dr. King, our prophet. I invite you to join me in this project and to keep talking about it and raising the questions. And so we started writing to Pope Benedict for a laugh. And gosh, we got a hearing. And then he stepped down, and Pope Francis invited some of us over. Most of you heard this, right? In 2016, the first ever conference on nonviolence at the Vatican. 80 people were invited, and all the Vatican muckety mucks. You had to end a war, be under constant death threat, or spend serious time in prison to be invited to the conference. I didn't know there was such incredible Catholic saints in the planet, people who had ended wars in Africa. They were. It was the greatest experience of my life, and everybody was there would say that. And the Pope sent, he didn't show up, and he sent a speech, which I hated, and the Cardinal, I shouldn't tell you this, but I'm on a roll. The Cardinal, I hope this isn't going to be recorded. He read this awful speech like, good luck, and that's so nice. And I went up to the Cardinal, the number two guy, and I was so furious. I hit him. Oh, what are you going to do? Bless me for I went up to Cardinal Turkson. I went, Cardinal Turkson, I don't need that. I need you to get the Pope to write a new encyclical outlawing the just war theory and converting the whole Catholic Church to gospel nonviolence. Without missing a beat, he hit me back and goes, I know who you are. I read all your books. And I'm going, and he goes, I got something for you. I need you to write the Pope's next World Day of Peace message called nonviolence. And they were ahead of us every step of the game. And we wrote it. It came out January 1st, 2017, Nonviolence, A Style of Politics for Peace, the first statement on nonviolence in the church since the Sermon on the Mount. Anything's possible, friends. And, you know, I can't vote because I'm an ex-con, you know, and I've had such a long criminal record. But, you know, no, seriously, it's no joke in my life. I'm in and out of jail my whole life. It's a way of life for me. You be raised by the Berrigans. It's a requirement of friendship with the Berrigans to get arrested. Yeah. Often and regularly, and now I have a real problem with recidivism, and it's not pretty. Anyway, talk about this. And, you know, Jimmy Carter invited me to come and give him a little retreat. And Bill Clinton, I think, is the only person who says he has all of my 40 books and he reads them over and over again. I'm trying to get him to do something about it. But what I'm saying is miracles are happening that I would never imagine. And I hear Jesus saying that. Just do this anyway, even though you don't understand it. No, this can't work. No, you do it, and then you reflect and see what happens. You act your way into a new way of thinking. You act whether you think it's going to work or not. And I saw Gandhi doing that and decided I would do that with my life. And I'm trying to plead with you to throw your lot in that. There's a million things you can do. If Martin Luther King were in this room, he'd say, we don't need anybody else on the planet. If everyone in this room committed your entire life to this gospel vision of justice and peace, we could change the world. That's the way Gandhi and Dr. King taught. But you have to be willing to give up your life from this day forward. That's what Jesus required. And so I don't know if that gets at your question. But like my hope, my whole modus operandi with the church and the world has been to try to really live what the poor guy said. I don't claim to be doing a good job of it at all, but I do claim to be trying through the help of a lot of friends and desperate prayer. I'm not saying I'm doing it. I'm trying. And I think that's all we're asked. And I'm seeing miracles happen. And so we just need to keep at it. That's what Tom Gumbleton was so amazing at. He just kept fearlessly speaking out on every issue he shouldn't be speaking out with. He'd meet with anybody. He flew over and met with the Iranians who were holding the 50 people hostage. Remember, he was part of their release, Tom Gumbleton. He did incredible things with all kinds of people. Well, thank you so much, Jack, and thank you for your passion. And I think that's kind of what the gospel is calling us to do. I'm in real agreement with Jack. It's to shine a light on this darkness. So we know that Lockheed, that the weapons used on Gaza's children are coming from Lockheed Martin. And I've heard that, because I know Scranton really well, in 1986, I was going to be sent to live and work in Chile, which was going to be my life in Latin America. I was going to leave the country. But I had disrupted Fordham University, where I was in grad school, because the head of the CIA came under Reagan. You remember him? And he was running the assassination program against the Sandinistas. And so they had one of the number one recruiting days for the CIA at Fordham. They particularly go after Jesuit schools. Well, I organized people, and some friends sat in and shut the whole thing down. And the CIA said they'd never go back there again. And so, thank you. And the provincial called me and said, well, we're sending you to a place that's never heard of peace or justice, Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I taught at the high school there right down the block from the munitions factory, which most of those bullets are being used on the children of Gaza tonight. It's right there in Scranton. I know that building really well. I used to walk around and pray there. And within a month, one of the fathers of my students was so appalled, he announced to the school that he was bringing his shotgun in and was going to kill me in front of my class. And the police came and all, and I thought, I had just come back from El Salvador, and I thought, wow, things are exciting here in Scranton. You can make a big difference by shining a light. You don't need to go to Gaza if you go to Scranton with Jack or go to the Lockheed Martin plant and just stand there with a sign, stop building weapons that kill children in Gaza. Not in my name, not with my money. No more killing. That's this guy. He's basically saying in the Sermon on the Mount, you are the light of the world. You're my disciple. So you go out as lambs and you speak on my behalf and say no more war, no more killing. In fact, no more death. I think resurrection means nonviolence. Resurrection means having nothing to do with death, nothing to do with violence, therefore total nonviolence. So when we do simple, ordinary things, like for 1 hour, hold a sign at the Scranton Munitions thing, which I think I did, we're getting ready for a resurrection. We're practicing resurrection. That's why this is so important. Don't just think of it as a thing. I got to do that, or I don't want to do it, but I got to go to the protest. No, it's a spiritual act. It's a sacrament. It's like going to Mass, which is a waste of time. Or is it? You know, if you have eyes to see, you know, if you're looking at it from God's perspective, God is simply not going to get involved. That's the point of this story. Unless we join in with God. God is just adamant that I am totally nonviolent, and the only way I can be totally nonviolent is to give you total free will to choose my way of peace and nonviolence or not. We've all rejected it long enough, and we have to take steps. And I'll end with this thought. I was thinking of Cesar Chavez, whom I knew pretty well in his last years, and maybe you heard me say this, Jack, but I said to him once, if people ever say to me someday, what should I do? What should I say? And Cesar Chavez said to me, tell everybody for the rest of your life, John, public action, public action, public action. He said, nonviolence requires some public action for peace and justice and discernment. I love that. You don't have to end the war, end all the wars. You just have to stand up publicly and do your little wee bit, as they say in Ireland. Have we resolved everything? No? No. Okay. Hey, thank you so much. Great to be here. I meant to encourage you. I hope it wasn't totally discouraging. God bless you. Be well. Do whatever Father Tim says. Buy 5 copies of the book. See you next time.